This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also download off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I'm delighted to have back in the studio with me Robert Jensen, one of the best activist academics in the country. Jensen is an associate professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas, Austin. He's the author of several books, including The Heart of Whiteness, Getting Off, Pornography and the End of Masculinity, Citizens of the Empire, and Writing Dissent, Taking Radical Ideas from the Margins to the Mainstream. And he's done just that, writing frequent commentaries for mainstream newspapers. His latest book is All My Bones Shake, Seeking a Progressive Path to the Prophetic Voice. And he's got an interview and documentary out called Abe Osheroff on the Joys and Risks of Living in the Empire. Robert Jensen, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Oh, it's great to be back, Matt. Thanks.
Empire is a big topic for you. You write about it. You've written about it a lot since 9/11 and in opposition to the Iraq War. What do you mean by empire?
Yeah, I think that this is the place where you see the difference between the conventional political spectrum, the liberal conservative debates that go on, and the critique that comes from the progressive side, from the left. And that's a critique not just of the way the United States goes about trying to run the world, but a more fundamental question about whether the United States has a right to engage in that. You know, we were supposed to have learned from the aftermath of World War II that it was time for the end of empires, but the United States emerged as the dominant power, unchallenged to a large degree, and has gone about the business of trying to run the world through economic and military force. And I think what it means to be a citizen of an empire is to be in constant resistance to that, not trying to shave the rough edges off of it, as the Democratic Party might try to do, but in fact to resist it at its core. And that means not only going up against the wars of empire, but the economic policies as well. It's a range of tactics that first world nations have used that I think we can do nothing but resist.
But how do you resist as a citizen when your government is acting in your name, whether it be waging an illegal war or engaging in torture, which, by the way, neither of which started with Bush Cheney, or just enjoying the fruits of the empire?
Yeah, well, I think that's the contradiction that we all know, that we live in the most affluent nation in the history of the world, and that affluence is a direct result of those imperial policies, in this sense, going all the way back to when Europeans landed in the Americas. That creates a whole lot of tension and stress for us all, and that's the price of admission. That's what it means to be fully human, is to take on those tasks. We do what we do depending on who we are and where we are. I happen to be extremely privileged. I'm a tenured academic, which means I can pretty much set my own schedule and say anything I want without risk of being fired. Not a lot of gigs like that in the world. I highly recommend it if somebody can land one. But it increases the obligation. The obligation is, quite frankly, first to speak the truth. I've spent my entire adult life in journalism or academic life, where one has the most, in a sense, the most space to speak the truth, but truth is so rarely spoken because people in those jobs have a certain status that is most easily maintained by hedging the truth. So we start by telling the truth about the fact we are an empire, and that there has never been an empire in human history that ruled benevolently. Every empire tries to sell that story, the British, the French, they all did. And the United States, of course, sells it as well. But it's a fundamental truth of history that empires never act in the interests of people abroad. So we have to start by telling that truth and then fashioning policies, programs, and movements that can resist. And, of course, there's a long tradition not only of an anti-war movement in the United States, but a principled resistance to empire. Your magazine, The Progressive, has been charting it for 100 years now, the Anti-Imperialist League from the turn of the century.
That was with Mark Twain as the vice president of the Anti-Imperialist League.
Mark Twain, William James, some of the great minds of the late 19th and early 20th century were profoundly in opposition to the imperial project as it was taking on a new force at that period in American history. So we build movements with a recognition that it's a long struggle. It's been going on for a long time. It's not going to end anytime soon. I think we attack it at the moment in the places it seems most vulnerable. My own political work as an active organizer started in the 1990s when the target was the Clinton administration, which was imposing on Iraq at that point the harshest economic embargo in modern history that was killing thousands of Iraqis every month because it was a democratic project, Democratic Party project. A lot of liberals stayed silent, but we tried to organize. And I think there's a lesson in that. We didn't change the sanctions policy. The economic embargo stayed in place until the Bush administration's invasion. But through the grassroots organizing that I was part of in the late 1990s, we started to build a network of anti-war, anti-imperial activists. And when 9/11 hit, when the war in Afghanistan, the war in Iraq took off, one of the things that allowed us to organize so quickly is that we had been building that network.
But if I might just jump in, Robert Jensen, and play devil's advocate, someone who would look at that and say, well, the lessons of both the sanctions movement and the anti-war movement is a lesson of failure. That is, we didn't get the sanctions overturned in the Clinton administration. We weren't able to stop Bush from waging these wars.
That's true. And in the short term, there was failure. But I think this is where one has to take the long view. You mentioned this interview and documentary that I did with Abe Osheroff. Well, Abe, his initial political activism came in the 1930s in the streets of New York, and it led him to go fight in the Spanish Civil War. The Republic fell to the fascists. They lost that one. Abe kept going. Abe engaged in all sorts of organizing after World War II, very important left organizing. All through the 1950s, Abe lost. The 1950s was a period of incredible political repression in this country, of course. But Abe and others like him kept at it. By the 1960s, a lot of the values that Abe embodied were emerging anew, and Abe was there to be part of that. In the 1980s, the election of Reagan, we saw a failure again. So when I look at the life of someone like Abe, who was a real mentor and a hero to me, in his 92 years on this planet, he just died last year, he went through periods where there looked like there was no hope. I mean, think of being a left organizer in the 1950s in the United States, McCarthyism at its height, no space for political dissent. Literally, freedom of expression was outlawed in the 1950s. Freedom of political association was outlawed. Abe lived part of that time underground. He kept at it. There's a whole history of activists who've kept at it. So I don't deny your assessment. In the short term, movements often do fail. But they also set the stage for progress in the future. Certainly the history of labor organizing in the United States, late 19th, early 20th century, lots of failures. The labor movement at one point crushed, yet it came back. And many of the progressive policies we have today, Social Security, unemployment insurance, are a direct product of the work of those people who in the short term failed.
I'm speaking with Robert Jensen. He's an activist, academic, what used to be called a public intellectual, but he gets his hands a little dirtier than that and actually walks the picket lines and goes to protests. He's the author of several books, including Citizens of the Empire. He's got a pamphlet-type book called Abe Osheroff on the joys and risks of living in the empire. We've just been talking. What kind of a guy was Abe?
Abe was really, I hate to use the term because it sounds so hoity-toity, but he was an organic intellectual. That means he was not only an activist, he was not only out in the streets organizing, he was thinking. Abe was a professional carpenter his whole life. He resisted the instinct to go into intellectual life or journalism. He wanted to have a trade that would allow him to be mobile, and he was a great carpenter, and he was able to travel the country and find work. And his life, though, was really dedicated to organizing and activism. What I respect most about Abe was that for his entire 92 years, he stayed open and self-critical. He was committed, passionately committed to social justice, and never hesitated to throw himself into struggles, but he was also always reflecting on the direction the movements were going. He was active in the civil rights movement, in every anti-war movement, labor organizing, organizing the unemployed. Abe just recognized that to live a meaningful life is not simply to enjoy the fruits of living in the most affluent country in the world, but to live a meaningful life was to engage in that ongoing struggle for justice. And when Abe died last year, there was an enormous outpouring at his memorial service, which reflected the people he had touched in his life. He didn't die with a big bank account. He died with an incredible network of friends who honored him for his achievements.
He talks in this pamphlet, in this interview you did with him, about being politically active as an endless hall. Now, an endless hall may sound not very inviting. And he also says there are no utopias, so we can forget about that too. But so how did he keep doing it? How do we keep doing it? How do we make it fun? How do we get joy out of it? Because joy is part of the subtitle of this leaflet you've got, pamphlet you've got.
Well, Abe made that comment when I said something about the long haul, and he corrected me. He said, kid. That's one of the reasons I liked Abe. He always called me kid, even though I'm rapidly advancing in age. He said, kid, it's not the long haul. It's the endless haul. He said, you cannot engage in activism expecting to win. He said, what you do is contribute to that steady march of progress. And I think that's an important lesson, because if we believe that our organizing is going to deliver results in some specific time frame, if that doesn't happen, then there's this sense of disappointment, and people often leave movements very quickly because of that. What Abe understood is that it's not that you don't care about winning. Of course, one wants to win. One wants to win both specific policy battles as well as win in the sense of always pushing the society toward a more just and sustainable setting. But what Abe realized is that there has to be a reward in the work itself.
And what's that reward?
And the reward, I think, is for Abe, you know, he used to stand up and say that he was richer than Bill Gates. Abe lived his life at the end in Seattle. Of course, he didn't mean that he was wealthier than Bill Gates. He meant that his life, the life of struggle, had put him in the presence of an enormous number of amazing people. And that in the end, we all realize at some point that our lives are measured not by our wealth, but by the people in our lives. And that struggle connects you to people in a meaningful way. That's certainly been the case in my life. I mean, I've had friends in my life, but the friends that I have stuck with, the friends that have been most meaningful, have been the ones I've met through struggle, through political work. And those are the relationships that tend to, I think, really get us through. And so it's both, I think, the case that we're motivated to do work for social justice by our ethics, by a sense of what the right thing to do is. But we also need, I think, a reward. And the reward is never going to be status. It's never going to be money. It's never going to be power in that sense. It's going to have to be a deeper and richer sense of being human. It's going to have to be the connections that we make and the people we have in our lives. And that was certainly true for Abe, and it's been true for me in my own life as well.
And mine as well. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. My guest is Robert Jensen, who is an associate professor at the School of Journalism at UT Austin and author of many books and articles. He's got a new book out, All My Bones Shake, Seeking a Progressive Path to the Prophetic Voice. What are you trying to do in this one?
Well, that was a book that reflects an interesting turn in my life in my mid to late 40s. You know, I had grown up in a very typical middle-of-the-road Protestant household. We went to church because we were forced to by our parents, who forced us to go to church because they thought that's what you did. But there was never a lot of very deep meaning in it. And the minute I was old enough to make my own choices, I fled from the church, never expecting to enter another one again. And then in my mid-40s, I just by accident bumped into an activist minister in Austin where I live, a man named Jim Rigby, a Presbyterian minister, although the denomination really doesn't matter. But his life was committed to social justice. He had almost lost his ordination at one point over his support for gay lesbian people in performing commitment ceremonies. He was openly, actively, and radically anti-war. He spoke out on the need for economic justice. He gave sermons denouncing capitalism as a fundamentally unchristian economic system. I mean, this guy was the real deal. And I bumped into him, and I started paying attention and started coming to the church to listen to his sermons. They weren't sermons preaching in the traditional sense of offering the standard theological doctrine. It was using the text and the tradition of Christianity as a launch pad to ask a simple question: how are we going to be decent human beings in this world we live in? And through that association, through meeting people in that congregation, I started to realize that church, as I have understood it, was not the only way to do church. And there were, in fact, progressive Christians, as well as progressive Muslims, progressive Jews, progressives of all stripes, that were out there trying to ground themselves in a text and a tradition, but take it into new places. And so I started going to that church, eventually joined that church. There was a little bump in the road. The denomination tried to kick me out when I wrote about the fact that I had non-traditional ideas about theology. But what I was really trying to ask is, if you leave the supernatural claims of religion behind, that is, you don't fuss too much about whether there is a God out there that's an entity, a force, a being that directs our lives, when you realize that that is part of a set of stories, not an account of the real world, if you don't fuss too much about whether Jesus rolled the rock back and rose from the dead, then there's a rich source of wisdom in those texts and traditions that we need to pay attention to.
What is some of that wisdom, Robert Jensen?
I think, first of all, we recognize that the human beings, in a sense, are living today as a species out of context. That most of our evolutionary history was lived as hunter-gatherers in a very natural balance with nature. And that when human beings started the process of domesticating plants and animals, agriculture, cities, the rise of civilizations, we, of course, unleashed an incredible amount of creativity, but we also started to cause a whole bunch of problems for ourselves and for the rest of the world. And I think most of the religions that we have today are in some sense an attempt to grapple with that, to encode in the religious language that was necessary early in our history as a species in this modern world, a certain set of ideas about how to stay sane, to stay in some sort of balance with a world with which we had, in a sense, fallen out of balance. So I think there's a rich source of lessons in that tradition. One of them is the lesson of humility. You go back to even to the beginning stories of the Hebrew Bible, the story of Genesis, the story of the fall, the expulsion from the garden. That can be read in a very, I think, regressive and reactionary way, but it can also be read as a story about the need for humility, the need for human beings to recognize the limits of what we can know. So I think one of the great lessons is humility. Another is, of course, the enduring message of social justice. What I'm saying is not that religion is the only source of these insights, but it is one source, and it's a source that, for whatever reason, is very powerful in our lives. Those stories, the stories from the Hebrew Bible and the Christian Bible, which are part of my tradition, just because I happen to have been born here, those are my stories every bit as much as they are the stories of Pat Robertson and the religious right. And I think the struggle to claim a different understanding of those stories is a profoundly political struggle as well as a theological one. And maybe it's just that I've gotten older. I've gotten more eclectic. I'm more willing to look for wisdom where I can find it. And I've found that within every denomination in Christianity, as well as within every religion, there are people struggling for that progressive understanding of the world through the text. I have a Muslim theologian friend named Fareed Isaac who wrote a book called On Being a Muslim, which is very much in the same vein of trying to explore the text and that tradition for the wisdom that can guide us toward justice, not toward more and more hierarchy.
I'm speaking with Robert Jensen. His latest book is All My Bones Shake, Seeking a Progressive Path to the Prophetic Voice. And you've written also about the need for each of us to speak in a prophetic voice and not to rely on leaders, prophetic leaders.
Right.
Why?
Well, I think we often think of the concept of a prophet as someone with special gifts, And when I went back and looked at the Old Testament prophets, Micah, Amos, and read some of the commentary, it struck me that we were misguided when we tried to put our faith in prophets instead of recognizing that the prophets of the Old Testament, of the Hebrew Bible, were in fact ordinary people. When Amos, one of the great prophets, was confronted by the high priest of the king and accused of being a prophet, he said, "I am neither a prophet nor the son of a prophet, but a simple shepherd and a dresser of sycamore trees." He was saying, listen, there's nothing special about me. I'm not claiming I'm special. I'm claiming that I have a responsibility and that the word of God means something. And what Amos and the other prophets were decrying, of course, was social injustice, the wealth inequality, the corruption of the age. And I think that we all have within us the capacity for the prophetic voice. I certainly don't claim any special status. I always remind people I'm from North Dakota, the least special place perhaps in the country. I don't have any pretensions when I talk about speaking in the prophetic voice of special insight or special skills. It's really more about recognizing our obligations to bring our stated beliefs in line with our actions.
But Robert Jensen, you and I are both in the business of projecting our voice. You're a journalism professor and you are a commentator, and I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. And so it's one thing for us to say it's all good and well for people to use their prophetic voice, but what do you tell someone who's listening right now in her kitchen or who is driving to work in his car and who doesn't enjoy public speaking and may share progressive views but doesn't view himself or herself as an evangelist? What should that person do?
Well, I think we have to recognize that when we speak in the prophetic voice, it need not always be in public. And you're, of course, absolutely right. Not everyone wants to get up in front of a group and speak. But that prophetic voice can be spoken in large settings. It also can be spoken in the most private and intimate of spaces. That is, we're all connected to other people. And we can all speak in that prophetic voice, even in those everyday spaces. I always think of a friend of mine who's out on the East Coast, who was always speaking prophetically in every situation he could ever find. You couldn't get into a cab with this guy without him engaging the cab driver in a conversation. And what I always respected about Sam was that he had the courage to go into any setting and make it a political space. You know, in this country especially, we're often hesitant to bring up politics or faith. We're always told that you should never talk about politics and religion, which is kind of odd, of course, because those are really the only two subjects in the world that are very interesting. But we often do, I think, hesitate to make the everyday spaces we live in political. And I think that's the way that everybody can speak in the prophetic voice. There are some of us who have loud voices. We're perhaps a little on the obnoxious side now and then, at least I would describe myself that way. But there are others who speak much more softly. And all of us have places where we can bring that prophetic voice. We all have contributions to make. I often think that some of the most important work I do is not the work that puts me in public, but the organizing work, the quiet work that goes on in Austin, Texas, where I live, where I look at what kind of assets I have to leverage. It might be that I have some money because I'm an overpaid academic. I realize that's redundant. Almost all academics are sort of by definition overpaid. But I have a certain amount of time. I have certain abilities to write. You know, I can leverage those toward social justice without being in public all the time.
And we all can do that simply by marching in a protest, which I think anonymously is one of the best things that I do. I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. My guest today is Robert Jensen. He is a associate professor at the School of Journalism at UT Austin and a activist extraordinaire and a great writer, a lot of books under his belt and commentaries continually. He likes to get his voice out there in the public. A lot of people, when they're looking for hope or optimism, you know, they look at a leader, and we saw this with the Obama campaign. People vested incredible ideals into him and foisted upon him these expectations that were perhaps unrealistic. What is your take on Obama?
Well, I think it's it hasn't changed much from the day he emerged as a fairly charismatic figure, which is that you do not put your hopes in leaders, number one, and you certainly don't put your hope in leaders who represent a fairly conventional spectrum of political power in the United States. All that said, I don't think anyone wants to trivialize the accomplishment of the election of the first non-white president. I mean, I would be the last person to make light of that. But I think I never expected much from Obama. He's a member of the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party has consistently shifted to the right in the last couple of decades. We can blame Bill Clinton and people like him for that. And so what would you expect from a president elected from a centrist party that represents Wall Street and corporate interests? Well, you'd expect policies that reflect those interests. And that's, in fact, what we're getting. Is he a refreshing change from 8 years of one of the most reactionary regimes in my lifetime? Sure. Is it refreshing to see a president who can speak intelligently, clearly, articulately, who has a sense of the world? Sure, all of that's true, and all of that's to the good. But it doesn't, as far as I can tell, shake the reality that we are an empire within a corporate capitalist system based on an idea of unsustainable growth.
And that makes him the emperor.
That makes him the emperor. And if we can't speak prophetically against this empire simply because the emperor is more palatable than the previous one, well, then we've lost our way politically. You know, my own view is that electoral politics simply isn't the arena that matters most right now.
How do we find our way politically?
Well, I think we have to, first of all, start by telling the truth. And the truth is that we live in a profoundly unjust and a fundamentally unsustainable world. We have to start to come to terms with what that means. So, for instance, in the issue of the Progressive, I was just reading a great article about the illusion of the hybrid car, the electric car, all of these things that were being sold to tell us that we can basically keep living in a car culture if we just get these new high-tech cars on the road. Well, that's a fantasy. We have to start by telling the truth. The transportation system in this country is going to have to change dramatically, and it's going to reshape the way we move about and the way we live. The fact is that the level of consumption that we in the first world, especially the United States, currently engage in is unsustainable, and it is going to change. And that change is going to bring about incredible social dislocation. We've got to start getting ready for that, both in terms of imagining a different world, a world that's not based on a high-energy, high-technology approach to living. We're going to have to think about new kinds of social networks, new kinds of interaction with our neighbors. None of that is going to come from Washington. Washington is simply incapable of conceptualizing the nature of the problem or even beginning to think about solutions to that. I think in some ways the real action politically is back down at the grassroots, not just to create movements to change politicians, but to create new ways of living.
Unfortunately, that's going to be the last word. It's an inspiring and provocative last word. Robert Jensen has been my guest on Progressive Radio. Robert Jensen teaches at UT Austin. Bob, thanks for being my guest today.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Matt.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.